Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is from our 2016 public television documentary film, Ideas That Change the World, the second part of a two-part series, The Real Adam Smith, A Personal Exploration by Johan Norberg. Adam Smith was a moral philosopher, a bold voice of the Spanish Enlightenment, the world's first economist, and the author of The Theory of Moral Sentiments and The Wealth of Nations. But in today's society, has the global economic system become so big and so complex that morality and human empathy are no longer relevant? Why are Smith's ideas still significant today? Listen now to find out, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
The progress of the last 250 years has been explosive. Year after year, the world and its people have grown more connected and more prosperous. It seems unimaginable. And yet, a man who lived in a world of sailing ships and horse-drawn carriages, of great wealth and great poverty, imagined our very world. He set pen to paper and recorded the ideas that would revolutionize the world's marketplaces. Free markets and global trade have created more prosperity and for more people in the past 200 years than was created in the previous 2,000 years. We are living longer and more comfortably than the vast majority of people who ever lived. But in today's seemingly ruthless competitive environment, where the stakes are high and winning is the name of the game, can an ethical and an honest business still prosper? Has the global economic system become so big and complex that morality and human empathy are no longer relevant? Where insiders and the rich get richer, and the middle class and the poor get poorer, and the free market is no longer free? I'm Johan Norberg, a writer and an analyst born and raised in Sweden, and these issues are of great concern to me. Therefore, I'll take a new look at the ideas of the man many consider to be the father of the modern world. He was a Scotsman named Adam Smith, a moral philosopher, a bold voice of the Scottish Enlightenment, and the world's first economist. He recorded his revolutionary ideas in two remarkable books, The Theory of Moral Sentiments and The Wealth of Nations. Those ideas changed the world, and in the next hour, we'll explore how they continue to power our world today.
Funding for this program has been provided by John Templeton Foundation.
The Maersk Mc-Kinney Møller is one of the largest ships in the world. It is also one of the most modern cargo carriers on the oceans today, carrying Adam Smith's ideas on world trade to a level imagined by only one man.
By opening a more extensive market for the produce of their labor, it encourages them to improve productive powers, and thereby to increase the real revenue and wealth of the society.
In command of the huge ship is Captain Jess Meinertz, a 25-year veteran of the sea lanes.
You see, the vessel's getting bigger and bigger. You have seen an increasing volume of cargo going from one part to another part. And I think that trend will continue.
The massive scope of international trade today would have been unimaginable even a few decades ago. But Adam Smith foresaw the workings of such a world more than 200 years ago. He wrote that free markets and free trade would connect the continents and result in global prosperity. Today's markets have grown to global proportions, and revenue and wealth have soared. Just one way that Adam Smith's ideas continue to change the world. Captain Meinertz and his crew are on a journey that will take them over 12,000 nautical miles, from Shanghai to three more stops in mainland China, Hong Kong, and then through the Suez Canal. Now, after 20 days at sea, they are nearing Algeciras, Spain. Then it will be on to Rotterdam and other European ports. The economic facts of life in the cargo business mean that bigger is better. Size is everything. The Maersk Mc-Kinney Møller is over 20 stories high and 1,300 feet long. This ocean-going behemoth carries 18,000 containers. If they were loaded aboard a train, the train would be 68 miles long. The containers hold everything, from fruits and vegetables to furniture and electronics, from appliances and kitchenware to vehicles and auto parts. a vast variety of consumer and industrial goods to feed the growing demand of a globalized world.
In China, for example, you have 1.2, 1.3 billion people, and the middle class is growing. And of course, there will be consumers like in the US and like in Europe. And of course, that will create even more a demand for goods to be transported around the world.
It's early evening when the ship arrives in Algeciras, Spain. Now, working through the night, over 2,500 containers will be offloaded within 10 hours. Then, once again, the ship will be on its way. Every day of the year, thousands of container ships enter hundreds of ports around the world. Adam Smith would be amazed. Every corner of the earth is now linked to every other. Each day, more people become connected by global trade. Each day, because of it, life gets better for millions of people. So who was this man who predicted that trade would lead to prosperity? Who foresaw this global progression out of poverty?
Smith took ideas of economics that were really in the bow and arrow stage and made them into a modern theory, which actually still drives our economic thinking today. People call him an economist. He was really a social psychologist. He wrote about ethics, he wrote about law, he wrote about politics, obviously wrote about economics.
The man many consider most responsible for today's prosperity, indeed the father of modern economics, first made a name for himself as a young man here in Edinburgh, Scotland. This historic city was then the center of the Scottish Enlightenment, and Adam Smith was one of its brightest lights. He had written an amazing book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, and that had propelled him into popularity. He would go on to write another, which was equally popular and eventually better known, The Wealth of Nations. Together, these two books described a powerful system of guidelines linking morality and economics.
Adam Smith was one of the greatest minds of all time.
His great gift was observation and his study of human nature as it appeared in different types of society at different periods of history is absolutely awesome.
Adam Smith was born in 1723 in the small seaside town of Kirkcaldy, Scotland, where he learned about morality and economics at the local merchant's market. He studied at Glasgow University, became its top administrator, and then a pillar of the unlikely intellectual revolution called the Scottish Enlightenment. He lived, lectured, and socialized in Scotland's capital city of Edinburgh. He had eloquently argued the power of free markets and the division of labor to enable people of all strata of society to become more prosperous.
The institutions that Adam Smith recommended have proved, empirically and historically now, to correlate positively with all of these metrics of human well-being.
Smith was particularly concerned about the well-being of the least well-off and thought that markets, especially the type of commercial society he wished to defend, would be of immense benefit to precisely those people.
He was the man that gave us modern economics with concepts like gross national product and productivity and supply and demand and labor and capital and all of these things we just take for granted today.
Smith matters because he posed a question that every single government since has had to address. Should governments intervene in the management of economies? Should they leave it to market forces?
Could market forces, on their own, alleviate poverty? Smith actually believed that they could. He had lived to see that his revolutionary ideas worked, to see life for the average Scotsman actually improve, and most important for Smith, that the poor were beginning to do better. So, do Adam Smith's revolutionary ideas, now over two centuries old, apply to the poor in today's developing world, as they did in Europe and America in Smith's day? Do they still have the power to transform the world? One success story with a surprising Scottish connection is Hong Kong. For much of its past, Hong Kong had been one of the great trading cities on Earth. Packed with thriving businesses large and small, Hong Kong had no natural resources and little agricultural land, only a beautiful harbor and a population of remarkably industrious people. By the 1960s, The colony was crammed with millions of refugees fleeing the civil war in mainland China. Hong Kong was a city hobbled by poverty. There were water shortages and thousands of refugee families called the harbor home. But everything would change because of the vision of one determined man, Sir John James Cowperthwaite, Hong Kong's financial secretary from 1961 to 1971. He was also a Scotsman and very much a disciple of Adam Smith.
Sir John Cowperthwaite is one of the great unappreciated heroes of political economy. He implemented in Hong Kong an experiment. He applied his theory of what he called benign neglect. So he instituted in Hong Kong the system of Smithian political economy to see what would happen.
Cowperthwaite built a Hong Kong that had relatively little corruption, an efficient and independent judiciary, individual property rights, and respect for the rule of law. He instituted an uncomplicated tax system with low rates on both individuals and business. The overall tax burden was half that of the United States at the time.
And he implemented the Smithian system of peace, easy taxes, and a tolerable administration of justice. And look what happened.
Little else is requisite to carry a state to the highest degree of opulence, but peace, easy taxes, and a tolerable administration of justice, all the rest being brought about by the natural course of things.
In Cowperthwaite's decade as financial secretary, real wages rose by 50%. Between 1960 and 2014, Hong Kong's GDP per capita adjusted for inflation increased more than 10 times.
And they turned what was effectively a rock in the 1950s to one of the most prosperous places on earth today.
Even now, under Chinese rule, Hong Kong remains one of the world's most important financial centers.
It's proof that with the right policies in place, change can come quickly. And today, the people of Hong Kong, despite continued unrest and demands for a greater say in their future, have a higher income per capita than their old colonial masters in Britain.
While Hong Kong, along with Japan and the other Asian tigers, was prospering, China was stagnating. 20 years of Soviet-style centralized planning and control had crippled the country.
After Mao died, both the Chinese leaders and the Chinese people recognized that socialism didn't work.
Ning Wang is professor of economics at the Ronald Coase Institute, an author with Ronald Coase of the book How China Became Capitalist.
They tried new ways to organize the economy, and what emerged spontaneous was something we here recognized as the market economy. And in China, it's called socialism with Chinese characteristics.
Socialism with Chinese characteristics translates to change from the ground up, or spontaneous development. Add to this the power of a market economy, and you have two of Adam Smith's most essential concepts.
They gradually opened up the economy, allowed private sector to enter in one industry after another. And of course, once the private enterprises entered any sector, they quickly outperformed state enterprises.
The small market economy, which leaders had allowed to even out the rough spots in centralized planning, mushroomed. Today, China's private sector contributes 60 to 80% to the country's job growth, and 60 to 70% of its GDP.
So that forced them to resort to their own tradition, seeking truth from facts, be practical, be open-minded, not trapped by any pre-existing ideology.
It's estimated that in the last three decades, over 600 million people have risen out of poverty in China. That's an accomplishment unmatched anywhere, at any time on Earth. And today, thousands of young Chinese are joining a global movement to discover how to maximize their nation's potential.
Tens of thousands of students from all over the world have come to America to study. Many of them are here at the University of Chicago, one of the world's foremost academic institutions.
Xingxing Li is a PhD student at the University of Chicago Law School. And she's studying the effects of government regulation on the economy.
And I just wanted to come here and learn from the best of the best, and then return to China and help to spread the knowledge to Chinese students.
This may be the best place on Earth to study the causes of wealth and poverty. Almost 30 professors, students, and alumni have won Nobel Prizes in economics.
Today, Professor Ning Wang is at the University of Chicago to preside over a unique seminar.
These University of Chicago scholars and students are from China, and they've all come together for a luncheon and a seminar to explore an interesting and surprising mix: Adam Smith, capitalism, and communist China. Such a conversation, even their presence here in the West, would have been unthinkable just a few years ago.
Good afternoon, welcome everyone. And we're going to have this seminar, Adam Smith in China. And we have a group of scholars, students, who have expertise on Adam Smith.
Adam Smith is the first generation of economic theorists.
I think classical economics would believe that, like, until market fails, there's no need for governmental intervention.
It is the highest impertinence and presumption in kings and ministers to pretend to watch over the economy of private people.
Yes, market works, but market needs something like morality. And people will trust each other, or at least they want to try to trust each other.
Adam Smith not only have one book called Wealth of Nations, he also have another great book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And in that book, he really lays out what kind of morality standards should the people have when they have the market kind of exchange.
I think they were surprised, happily surprised, that actually what they got from Adam Smith actually consistent with their own tradition. Traditions from Confucianism and the traditions from Taoism.
Chinese students are not just studying Adam Smith in the West, they're studying him in China. All of the major Chinese universities teach the ideas of Adam Smith, and they are learning how their own traditions are similar to those of the West.
It doesn't surprise me at all that more people in China read Adam Smith than, you know, the people here in the States. The previous Chinese premier, Wen Jiabao, in many occasions praised the theory of moral sentiments. And I remember once he visiting a Chinese campus, and in front of students, he reads that book. Hey guys, you have to read this book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments.
Is China coming full circle? Will it once again embrace its cultural roots with a deeper understanding of how its history and commercial traditions merge naturally with the ideas of Adam Smith and contemporary market economics? Is communism the future of China? Or will it be seen as just an aberration, a blip in China's long history?
But for China to move forward, it has to strengthen its own innovative capacity. The most severe defect of the Chinese system is that China now has an open market for goods, but doesn't have a free market for ideas.
A free market not only opens our minds to new ideas, it helps us to be far more productive. From thousands of independent suppliers around the world, millions of parts have been shipped to Airbus in Toulouse, France. Here, they will be assembled into the largest and most modern airliner on Earth, a product of the vast benefits of a global division of labor, a concept popularized by Adam Smith.
The division of labor, so far as it can be introduced, occasions in every art a proportional increase of the productive powers of labor.
Few things better illustrate the benefits of the division of labor than factories like this. Smith would have been amazed. What was an extraordinary insight in Smith's day, the productive potential of the division of labor, is now a commonplace, common sense, global phenomenon.
Here we are in our mock-up hall here in Toulouse. We have full-size models of the major models that we produce for Airbus.
Alain Pardo is the head of marketing communications at Airbus in Toulouse, France.
They're fully furnished, so they have seats and galleys and furnishings, just like a real airplane. If you like, it's sort of a showroom. We are many thousand people in Toulouse, but we're of course a global company, we're not just French. So an A380 is a very big aeroplane. In fact, it's the world's largest commercial aeroplane. And what really distinguishes it is the fact that it's got two decks, two levels, two cabins. And it's an aeroplane that probably has something in the order of 4 million individual parts. 2.5 million of those are unique part numbers. We must have something in the order of 1,500 suppliers in probably about 30 countries.
And each of those suppliers does what they do best. They specialize in their own area of expertise.
The wings are constructed in England, and each contains 32,000 individual parts.
The wing is enormous. It's huge. The wingspan of this aeroplane is about 80 meters. That's something in the order of 250 feet. So it's bigger than almost every other aeroplane ever flown, and certainly the largest commercial aeroplane flown.
Smith first described the division of labor by looking at the manufacture of simple pins. We've come a long way since, but the principle is still the same. The larger the scale of the cooperation, the greater the chance of specializing.
I think for one company to try to do everything on its own would be prohibitively expensive in terms of just not money, but resource, people, know-how. It's a global business. People fly around the world day in, day out. It's a global supply business. It's a global manufacturing business.
You concentrate on doing the things that you're good at. I concentrate on doing the things that I'm good at. And then we exchange. And then we're both really much, much better off because we're very much more efficient.
What we see in the world today in a globalized economy is millions, indeed billions, of people who are cooperating with one another in innovative new ways around the world. In some sense, that really is the Adam Smithian world.
With incredible machines like these, we can travel from one continent to the other, supported by a vast network of millions of people and thousands of systems that keep everything up in the air.
And while we're flying, tons of freight is traveling with us in the cargo holds. But by far, most products traded between nations still travel, as they did in Smith's day, on the seas. With every one of the allotted containers unloaded in Algeciras, the Maersk McKinney Møller is ready to depart. A cargo ship rests at its dock only long enough to unload and load. At most ports, the crew never leaves the ship. Before dawn, with the moon setting behind the mountains, she heads into the crowded Strait of Gibraltar.
I'd say that a favorite place to be on the bridge, watch the sun rises. And you have this deep orange sun coming up, and you see the light changing in the horizon just before it breaks.
One, two, three. Aboard the Maersk McKinney Møller, the crew on the giant ship settles into their daily rhythm, checking the bracing on the containers, keeping the ship clean, and performing routine maintenance. Maersk is a Danish company. The captain and his senior officers are from Denmark. The rest of the crew is international.
That is correct, leaving Algeciras bound for Rotterdam.
In the past, everything has to be done manually. Nowadays, a lot of the functions that we control are done automatically via computers and monitors. And that, of course, requires less manpower. A officer or navigator nowadays is actually, he's not steering the big wheel anymore. He's basically monitoring all the automated systems on board.
The 24 crew who run the ship are spread over its quarter mile length. They seldom see one another. They come together at mealtime, three times a day. Romy, the Filipino cook and oldest member of the crew, prepares a diverse menu with dishes that make the men feel at home. It's a time to relax, share information and plan for the work ahead. This huge ship demonstrates the impact Adam Smith envisioned international trade would have on prosperity. It's not what's in the containers, but what they represent that's important.
Smith believed that wealth is not just the things you own, like gold in the bank, but also your labor and the things you can get in exchange. The more others create, and the more you trade with them, the better off you are.
And with ships like this, world trade is much more efficient and environmentally friendly. At the heart of the vessel is its unique state-of-the-art propulsion system.
They are what they call super long stroke. When you have super long stroke, you have a slower speed.
Per Schilling Nielsen is chief engineer. He's been with Maersk for 25 years.
They're doing maximum 73 revolutions per minute. They're directly linked to the propeller. That means the propeller is doing maximum 73 RPM.
The long stroke engine is designed to squeeze the most miles possible out of every drop of oil. It lowers fuel consumption by 37% and carbon dioxide emissions per container by 50%.
We spend a lot less fuel consumption moving one box from one of the major ports in the Far East to one of the major ports in Europe.
In fact, per container, this ship emits less greenhouse gas than almost any other method of transportation. It emits less CO2 per ton of goods moved, 15 times less than a truck and 6 times less than rail. Much of this efficiency is due to the sheer number of containers secured on board.
We are carrying these close to 60% of the cargo below the deck. So, and people have a tendency to forget that because you don't see it, it's just hidden below the hatches of the ship.
René Hansen is the ship's chief officer, and among other tasks, is in control of the cargo.
Looking at a stack like this, we see we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 stacked on top of each other. This combined with loading 9 on deck gives a very good idea that the vast amount of cargo that is being carried, which you cannot see when the ship just passes by on the open oceans.
So whatever you can imagine that can be put inside this box, we can more or less carry.
And today, more and more of what's carried aboard ship are perishable goods, enabling growers to sell into markets thousands of miles away at a fraction of the cost of air freight. Torben Andersen is the electrical engineer aboard ship.
Every morning I go around and look at every single container, see if there's any malfunctions, if the temperature is as it's supposed to be.
Everything that you put in your refrigerator at home, we put in the refrigerators on board the ship just in vast scales. And if we look at our refrigerated containers, we can carry flower bulbs from Netherlands for tulips, we can carry chocolate from Poland, we carry wine, expensive French wine we carry in refrigerated containers.
Fruits and vegetables stay fresh for dramatically longer periods of time.
We can make an artificial atmosphere in our containers.
By controlling the levels of oxygen, carbon dioxide and nitrogen.
And then as we're getting closer to the port of delivery, we will start increasing the oxygen level in the container, and then the bananas are, so to speak, ready when they hit the supermarket.
The shelves of supermarkets throughout the world are stocked with goods transported aboard cargo ships like the Maersk Mc-Kinney Møller. This is a Whole Foods market in Austin, Texas. There are over 400 Whole Foods markets in the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. They sell products from around the world. Their whole trade guarantee promises that consumers can shop with a conscience. Most business people are honest and ethical. In fact, it turns out that the more ethical they are, the better the company performance. In the cutthroat supermarket business, it's important to stake out your own territory. The company's motto is Whole Foods, Whole People, Whole Planet. At the center of this amazing story is co-founder John Mackey. To understand Whole Foods market, you have to understand him.
The original vision for Whole Foods was, very simply, is we wanted to sell healthy food to people, earn a living, and have fun. The higher purpose of Whole Foods has become a lot deeper and more complex than it was back 34 years ago.
And that brings us to mission. Mission is something Mackey takes seriously. It's not just platitudes for a wall plaque in a corporate lobby. It's the statement that embodies his ethical perspective.
We want to sell healthy food to people, help people to reach their highest potential through having good health. We also have a sense that the people that work for us should be flourishing and should be happy in their work, and we also feel a responsibility for the larger communities that we're trading with.
It's been on Fortune's 100 Best Companies to Work For list for 18 years in a row. What seems to make Whole Foods so successful is that the people who work here are strongly committed to all the stakeholders, to customers and team members, to stockholders and suppliers, which has resulted in highly committed employees and very faithful customers. And a lot of John Mackey's philosophy is based solidly on Adam Smith.
I mean, Adam Smith was so far ahead of his time. The totality of his ideas are still very, very important and very relevant today.
Smith gives us a way of thinking about markets and morality together. For Smith, these are not two things that can easily be extricated from each other, as if one can simply talk about rational economic men on one hand, and then moral men in a different sphere on another.
Smith understood that you're going to be better at business if you can understand your customers and generally sympathize with them, as well as understanding and sympathizing with your employees.
The chipotle, the lemon, the garlic and basil, and the sesame ginger. I really like how you...
I think that most of our guests, when they walk in the door, know that there's something different. For a lot of people, it's the energy of the team members, right? I think a lot of our team members feel empowered and feel fulfilled and therefore feel happy and satisfied in their work.
Lindsay Mucha is store team leader of one of the Whole Foods markets in Austin. She's been with Whole Foods for over 10 years.
My goal was to work here for 6 months, graduate from college, and then go off and find my career path. And I very quickly fell in love with Whole Foods. I loved the values and the mission.
The greatest source of creativity and innovation exists in our team member base. A big part of what we're trying to do is allow them to be themselves, to be authentic, to be spontaneous, allow them to experiment, to create new things, to create the innovations.
This helps to illustrate Adam Smith's principle that top-down command structures aren't always the best. Things organize themselves better from the bottom up.
The natural effort of every individual to better his own condition is so powerful that it is alone capable of carrying on the society to wealth and prosperity.
Many of the institutions that we have, language, markets, you name it, these are indeed the results of human action, but they're not the results of human design. We never plan these things, they just evolve naturally.
So note that phrasing, individual human action, but not individual human design.
You don't need a central planning authority to run your society well.
And that's a really cool thing about the Whole Foods market culture. You know, it's not top down, it's not a mandate on everything. If someone has a good idea that someone else likes, there's a good chance it's gonna spread and work for a lot of people.
Carol Medeiros is produce coordinator at Whole Foods Markets in Austin, Texas.
I would say that, you know, we're always trying to find what's new and what's next, and a lot of times, most of the time, our best ideas come from the team members that work in the stores every day.
Because the team members genuinely care, because it's theirs, right?
Whole Foods Market's success in promoting healthy foods has spawned increased competition in the marketplace. In response, the company is opening a new line of stores called 365 by Whole Foods Market, which they hope will make their products more accessible to more consumers.
When stakeholder philosophy is adopted in a more conscious way and businesses begin to act in a more conscious way for a higher purpose, I think most of the hostility towards business and capitalism will disappear.
And I think what's really nice about this and companies that are able to be mission-driven and purpose-driven and still be profitable, it's that when you put that out there for people to choose, there are people who choose it. And there are people who will vote with their dollars, right? And do it because that's what's valuable to them. So I think that's nice. It's about choice.
For markets to make good on the hope that they would bring what Smith called universal opulence to all ranks of people, Smith thought that it was necessary for them to be supplemented by a certain conception of morality.
By morality, Smith meant fairness and a level playing field for all. But what happens when some are able to tilt the market to their advantage?
Adam Smith asked the very same question 250 years ago. And the problem can be easily illustrated by taking a walk in the woods. In state and national parks all across the United States, you'll often find signs like this that say, please do not feed the animals.
Because if you feed the wild animals, they lose the ability to gather food in the wilderness. And as a result, they tend to be less resilient and their survival is at risk.
Luigi Zingales is professor of entrepreneurship and finance at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago.
I think that a similar sign should be put in Washington to say, please don't feed business. Precisely because I love business, I don't want business to become fat and unable to compete in the global marketplace.
Smith was very suspicious of partnerships between government and business. That's effectively what we call cronyism today.
This is the result of feeding the animals Washington style. In recent years, housing values around the US capital have skyrocketed.
There is no real industry, there is no real commerce, and it's pretty scary that wealthiest counties in the United States are in the suburbs of Washington, D.C.
The top two richest counties in the United States and six of the top 10 are suburbs of Washington, D.C.
All that money is basically money that is sucked from the system and wasted in lobbying.
Lobbying pays very well, and not just for the lobbyists. The real payoffs go to the corporations they represent.
Smith thought that any institution, government included, could become corrupted if it was too big and made too many decisions centrally.
To widen the market and to narrow the competition is always the interest of the dealers. Any new law or regulation of commerce ought always to be listened to with great precaution.
A series of recent governmental regulations illustrates Adam Smith's fear. Corn ethanol is a biofuel. It's basically fuel that comes from corn. It's more costly and far more inefficient to make than ethanol from sugar. But now, almost 40% of the nation's corn crop goes into making ethanol, which has driven the price of corn way up. It makes corn farmers and processors happy because it gives them a guaranteed profit. But all of us have to pay more for foods that use corn, especially meat and poultry. The fuel companies are required by federal law to buy ethanol, whether they want it or not, or whether motorists want it or not. Between 2007 and 2012, the corn ethanol lobby spent $139 million and in return gained over $28 billion in corn ethanol tax credits.
So once you have this kind of returns, then people will not invest in R&D, they will not invest in new sort of organizational form, they will not invest in new technology, they will not invest in new property, plant and equipment, they will invest in lobbying.
Many corporations prefer to get their profits by legislating them, rather than by selling goods and services that people want on an open market. Adam Smith saw exactly the same forces at work in his day.
What Smith saw was that when business people go to the government and they say, we want a special royal charter, we want special protections from competition, we are a vital national industry and we need special privileges, you gotta be careful. Because when this happens, this is really people conspiring to protect their own interests at the expense of others.
Adam Smith understands that in order for competition to work its magic, you need to have rules in place, because otherwise, rather than competition, you have the law of the jungle.
This is Adam Smith's key insight. Competition is not a way of giving power to companies. It's a way of giving us power over them.
The founding fathers not only established a government of the people, by the people, for the people, they also established an economic system of the people, by the people, for the people. This is what distinguishes the United States from the rest of the world, and this is what gives us hope.
But is it possible to have markets that operate in the interests of sellers and buyers without a lot of government regulation? The answer might be yes, if they embody Adam Smith's ideas. It used to be that when you wanted to go someplace in a city, you had to wait for a taxi or rent a car. But now with apps like Uber and Lyft, that's all changed. Lyft?
Yes.
Hi, are you David?
Yes.
People today ride with strangers in their cars, and with sites like Airbnb, they sleep in strangers' homes. It's just a tiny part of a much larger and much more important social trend, an explosion of trust enabled by the internet. And the granddaddy of them all is eBay.
Almost every country in the world has buyers and sellers who work inside the eBay marketplace.
Devin Wenig is CEO of eBay Marketplaces.
eBay is founded on this principle of economic democracy, that individuals around the world who don't know each other and have never met can work in a system to be able to conduct economic transactions fairly and securely and have confidence in that.
eBay was founded in 1995 by Pierre Omidyar.
Pierre thought very strongly about the notion of the free market. He believed in Adam Smith's principles. He believed that an economic democracy would not only be a great business, but it had the potential to do immense amounts of good around the world.
eBay has hundreds of thousands of small sellers around the world that are now doing more than half their business outside of their national borders. One retailer that is profiting in this new era is Gelb Music.
Gelb was started in 1939, about 75 years ago, located right here in Redwood City, California. It's been here ever since, and carry about a little over 50,000 products here.
Mike Craig is Gelb's e-commerce marketing manager.
We have a complete line of drums, bass, guitars, recording equipment. We were waiting for our own website to be built. We took about 200 products, mostly snare drums, did about $200,000. The test definitely worked. The following year, we put up about 1,000 products, maybe a little bit over, and we did about $750,000 in sales.
We now have about 160 million active consumers who buy and sell in our marketplace every day. We now sell a little less than $90 billion of goods every year, and consumers access us from over 190 countries.
Well, eBay has saved the store number one, but it's also opened our eyes to markets that we didn't think were obtainable.
One of the great things about marketplaces is that they act as an incredible price discovery mechanism.
Because if you're looking at a collectible, or a coin, or a comic book, or a rare automobile, the likelihood is that there were more sales in eBay for that particular item than in any other marketplace in the world.
Adam Smith would have said that an invisible hand guides eBay sellers around the world. As prices are on the rise, because buyers want a particular item, sellers stream into the market to satisfy that demand. And when demand drops, prices go down.
Imagine a world where there's screens everywhere. Those screens are connected to a global marketplace. That global marketplace has all the world's inventory priced fairly because it's an open marketplace. And you're one click away from buying anything you want at any time for a fair price.
There are millions of exchanges each minute, all of them without regulation, among strangers, across borders and oceans. It's an enormous amount of business based solely on trust.
Pierre's notion was, let the buyers and sellers in the marketplace determine who the best buyers and sellers are. So the eBay feedback system was born.
The way ratings work is that when you sell a product, the customer can go back and rate you. Was it a good experience? Was it a bad experience? And that goes onto your record where everyone sees it.
Public services are never better performed than when their reward comes in consequence of their being performed and is proportioned to the diligence employed in performing them.
I think being judged by your customers is a wonderful idea. I think that keeps us as sellers on our toes. You have to deliver on what you promise. And if you do that, you're rewarded by more customers and you'll grow.
The free market isn't about robbing people or cheating them or stealing from them. It is about cooperating with them. If people trust you, if you're giving them a good service, they will do business with you. If you're trying to cheat them, they might deal with you once, but once they've been cheated, you'll never see them again.
Part one of the promise is a fair, open, fast, trusted marketplace that's enabled by technology.
Coordinating a global marketplace like this takes one of the largest site operation centers in the world.
We do about 300 million searches a day on the eBay marketplace. There are computers and people and systems and processes that all have to work in sync to make sure that that's working 24/7.
When we look at forecasting and eBay's gonna make up anywhere from 50 to 80% of our sales, that's a huge number.
There is a concept of a micro multinational, which I think is fascinating. And there are hundreds of thousands of them alive inside the eBay marketplace.
It's that family-owned, independent, just homegrown kind of store. We're just being able to sell around the world now.
So without either a strong corporate intervention in the sense of eBay, or a strong government or regulatory intervention, this is a community that has grown enormously because, in essence, it's self-regulated. A free market is one of the most powerful forces on earth. And we've seen that. with our business.
Adam Smith presented his ideas on the free market in his second great book, The Wealth of Nations, which was published in 1776, just months before the American colonies exploded in revolution. Copies made their way across the Atlantic and into the hands of those shaping the structure of the new republic.
The founders were dealing with things like how to structure a government, an economy, the banking system, the church, the military, and Smith had a lot of things to say on all these points. So, does the United States follow Smith's principles? The answer can be found here at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
The Library of Congress is the largest library in the world. Its holdings include more than 32 million catalog books and other print materials, and the largest rare book collection in North America.
Included in the collections is the personal library of founder Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence and a lifelong admirer of Adam Smith.
His library at the time numbered 6,487 volumes.
Mark DeMunation is chief of the Rare Book and Special Collections Division at the Library of Congress.
Certainly one thing you can learn by looking at Jefferson's library is the pervasiveness of Enlightenment philosophy and intellectual conversation that plays throughout the creation of the American government. In fact, you could claim that Jefferson's book collection brings the Enlightenment to America.
In 1814, the British attacked and burned Washington. On learning of the burning of the Capitol and the loss of the 3,000-volume Library of Congress, Jefferson offers Congress his personal library as a replacement.
And in 1815, gentlemen arrived with horse-drawn wagons, took a collection that took Jefferson 50 years to build, left him in Monticello. He never saw his books again, never went to Washington again.
But a second fire on Christmas Eve in 1851 destroyed two-thirds of those volumes.
Through a private grant, the Library of Congress is now reassembling Jefferson's library as it was when he sold it to Congress 200 years ago.
It was the entire world of Thomas Jefferson's mind, the understanding of the roots of so much of what influences American culture, the nature of the Constitution, the nature of the Revolution, the foundation of separation of church and state, the whole philosophy of politics as it is in the United States is embedded in that collection.
One book that has survived is Thomas Jefferson's original copy of The Wealth of Nations.
This is the three-volume set of Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. These are books that belong to Thomas Jefferson. He writes a lot about his reading, but he very rarely marks his books. There's no underlining here. There's no good idea used in the Declaration of Independence. There's nothing like that. So you really have to read what Jefferson says about books in order to understand what he gains from them.
Jefferson didn't just read Smith's book. He frequently studied it, referenced it, and recommended it to others.
In a letter to John Norville, Jefferson writes, "If your views of political inquiry go further to the subjects of money and commerce, Smith's Wealth of Nations is the best book to be read."
There has to have been a moment in which Jefferson and Hamilton had a conversation that was at least laced with Smithian philosophy, if nothing else, whether they identified him or not. This is a book, however, that Jefferson would take seriously.
But Jefferson wasn't the only Smith devotee among the founders. James Madison, considered the principal author of the Constitution, was also an admirer.
I think of Madison as having a view of government very similar to Smith's in a very, very deep way.
Sam Fleischacker has written extensively about Adam Smith's influences in colonial America.
Both Madison and Smith believe that human beings are strongly motivated by self-interest, but also capable of virtue, and that what you want to do is design institutions such that, first of all, freedom is protected whether people are acting in a self-interested fashion or not, and secondly, they have the opportunity to develop their virtues.
So the founders certainly knew of Smith and his works. But to what extent did Smith influence the American character? Is the United States Smithian?
I think the United States is Smithian in its bones.
Smith fits extremely well with the vision of the founders and indeed of the vision of most Americans from that time till our own.
And what you see in the Constitution is an attempt to implement and integrate into a governmental plan some of the ideas Smith had about what could allow for a prosperous society.
Every man is left perfectly free to pursue his own interest in his own way. The sovereign is completely discharged from a duty for which no human wisdom or knowledge could ever be sufficient. The duty of superintending the industry of private people.
The United States sees itself and talks about itself as a land of opportunity. That's really the Smithian vision in a nutshell. You have a limited government with a few but specific and robust protections. Much of the actual work of making your life better was left to the individuals.
But to do that in a way that was stable, to do it in a way that had long-term benefits, to do it in a way in which there weren't simply the concerns of the moment, but to have a lasting constitutional order. This, I think, binds the American founders to the Scots, and especially to Smith in a deep way.
Well, here you have a groundbreaking book in how to run an economy. And more than that, it's really a general book on politics. So it makes a good deal of sense that these people who are founding a new country would look over to the best work in the Enlightenment, not just to Smith, but to the other great social scientists of the day, as it were, and be particularly interested in them.
Ideas matter. When faced with the challenge of how to create and structure a new nation, the founders turned to the Enlightenment and to Adam Smith for guidance. As the Maersk Mc-Kinney Møller steams across the English Channel, she's just a day from her next port of call. Now the pace aboard ship quickens. Lines are prepared for tomorrow's docking. Unloading and loading schedules are reviewed, and charts for the approach to the next harbor are studied. Their destination is the largest port in Europe. Here, where the Rhine meets the North Sea, is the port of Rotterdam in the Netherlands. It is the gateway to the markets of Western Europe. It is the point of entry to a vast network of rail, highways, and inland waterways that serves 350 million people. It's pitch dark and hours from dawn when the Maersk Mc-Kinney Møller finally nears the entrance channel to the port of Rotterdam. Bringing a ship this size to a safe berth in such crowded sea lanes will require keen judgment and expert skills.
Mass approach. This is Maersk Mc-Kinney Møller. Mass approach, go ahead.
When a vessel approaches the port, you have this interaction informing you about the in and outbound traffic, the weather conditions, if there's any change to the pilot time. And
Maersk Mc-Kinney Møller, ETA 0645, your draft 14.9. Is that correct, over?
Mass approach, Maersk Mc-Kinney Møller, that's correct, over.
Still hours before dawn and 14 miles off the Dutch coast, the boat carrying the pilot pulls alongside. To guide the vessel into the crowded port, the local pilot will rely on his unique knowledge and experience. From now until they dock, the pilot and the captain are a team.
We slowly maneuver the vessel into the port, and it's a quite kind of slow process, but Rotterdam Port, it's one of the biggest ports in the world. A vessel like this, you can't turn like a car, so every maneuver and every turn and every swing takes time. A vessel this size, you cannot stop like this. You've got to plan your maneuver, and you always need to have a plan B if plan A is not working.
That'll stop.
Joining the Maersk Mc-Kinney Møller are almost 100 other cargo ships, a third of them from Asia. In the last 40 years, global trade increased from less than $2 trillion to almost $19 trillion. And Adam Smith predicted that that kind of development would also result in a reduction in global poverty. In fact, 750 million people were lifted out of poverty over those 40 years.
As the last containers are unloaded from the Maersk Mc-Kinney Møller, those offloaded first are making their way to waiting trucks, where they will be delivered throughout Europe.
And Adam Smith would argue that those containers don't just carry products. They carry prosperity and a better quality of life.
200 years ago, a man who lived in a world of sailing ships and horse-drawn carriages imagined how much better the world could be. He wrote two masterpieces, providing an astonishing roadmap.
He wanted to create the conditions by which ordinary people could go about their own business and to work and save and prosper and help themselves and their families.
He wasn't interested in protecting the wealth of the already privileged, the moneyed, the aristocrats. What he was interested in is how can we raise the estates of the least among us?
And I think that the two books together form a coherent project in trying to give a vision of a commercial society that was not just a market society, but also a market society built on a very particular conception of morality.
Every generation has to cope with the problem of how far should governments intervene in the business of trying to maximize the wealth of their own country.
Perhaps more than any other person, Adam Smith's ideas have led directly to the first real broad-based advancements in mankind's quality of life in thousands of years. He was a proponent of free markets and morality. His writings and ideas have spread around the globe. And in spite of the progress we have yet to make, his ideas truly changed our world.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.